This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Vincent Cunningham, one of our theater critics, on stage at the New Yorker Festival with the playwright Susan Laurie Parks.
It feels very stilted to read an introduction for you because I always tell people the first Broadway show I saw was Cats as a middle schooler. And the second one was Top Dog Underdog. It's one of the reasons I studied literature, cared about the theater. You like sort of are the reason I'm even here talking to you. So I just am so happy to be here with you.
As Vincent said, Parks' influence has been enormous over the years. She's still probably best known, though, for Top Dog Underdog, a two-man show about a pair of brothers named Lincoln and Booth. They're struggling with poverty, with the weight of American history, and their own bitter rivalry. Top Dog Underdog opened on Broadway in 2002, and 20 years later, it's just been revived in a production with Corey Hawkins and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. Here's Vincent Cunningham talking with Susan Laurie Parks.
Susan Laurie Parks is the first African-American woman to receive the Pulitzer Prize in drama. Other of her awards include the MacArthur Genius Grant, the Dorothy and Lillian Gish Prize. Her theater credits include Top Dog Underdog, The Book of Grace, Unchain My Heart, the Ray Charles musical, and the upcoming plays for the Plague Year, which we'll talk about. She wrote the screenplays for The United States versus Billie Holiday and Girl Six, wrote the novel Getting Mother's Body, which I'm sorry, I will pay back one day. I read the whole thing in a Barnes & Noble when I was in college. I'll Venmo you for that experience. and she was the creator, head writer, and executive producer for the series Genius. Additionally, Susan Laurie Parks fronts the band Sula and the Noise. Thank you so much for being with us. It's such an honor.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
We should start with Top Dog Underdog because it's being revived on Broadway. You kind of shocked the theater world and the rest of the world when it came out. It felt like an avalanche. Now you, of course, are working with a different pair of wonderful performers. How do you even think about it living in other bodies?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, as a playwright or as a writer of dramatic literature, you know, that's something that we grow accustomed to, you know. I write my specifically plays. I mean, films are, you know, that's just for the one actor and they do the performance. But with plays, you have to write it so that it endures. You know what I'm saying? It has to be passed around from hand to hand, from community to community, from continent to continent, through the ages, long, hopefully, after you pass away. And the script will endure and be something that artists can come to and embody. And it's built like that. It's built with that in mind, if it's written well. So I believe that Top Dog is written very well, and it has been done by many, many, many people, and not only men of African descent. All kinds of different folks have felt like, hey, I have a place in here. Might I do it also? And I'm like, sure, it's your production. Go for it. You know what I mean? And so I just sit back, and Kenny Leon is such a brilliant director, and I just sit back and go, yeah, that looks good. Like that. It's very, no, I did change the one thing they were talking about. You give someone your number and you tell them that you have a home. Because in 1999, when I wrote it, landlines were the thing, right? And now I've changed it. It's the same rhythm. So you give someone your number, telling them one thing, that you have a home. You give someone your number, telling them one thing, that you have a phone. Hello. Right. So it's the same rhythm, different words, because now giving someone your phone number tells them that you have a phone, not necessarily a home. So little changes like that, but it wasn't specific to the guys.
You know, right.
It was just the world that we live in now.
Wow. Do you think metrically like that when you write?
Totally. Totally. So they say, scripture says, and I am a fan of scripture, in the beginning was the word, mm-hmm. right? But that might just be the word's point of view. I mean, all respect intended. But that might just be the word's point of view. Because I had a notion last night. In the beginning was the groove. And that I was like, yeah. Because the groove, I think, comes before the word. See, so this is me up late at night thinking. You know, or feeling thing and surmising, yeah. perhaps. Because I do write to the groove. I write to the groove. Just to the groove. And I can tap it out. It's all lyrics to me.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you say that your dad, when you were young, you moved around a lot.
Yeah, he was in the service. He was in the army. He was in service. Yeah.
I've heard you say that he bought, when you were a kid, a baby grand piano that you took around with you.
Yes.
So would you say? I mean, in the same way that, like, you know, cosmically,
yes.
first comes the groove. The groove came first for you, autobiographically, right? I mean, it was that. Before right. you were interested in writing, were you interested in music?
Oh, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I was definitely started out as a musician, someone who loved music, someone who played music very not so great on the piano. So my mom loved jazz. They both loved soul music. My dad loved opera. And he's, 6'4", darker shade of soul brother, you know. He would walk around the house lip syncing to Puccini and Wagner. And we would just sit there. You're like, what is this? Dad, you know, and then by day he would put on a uniform and he'd go and be in the army. And then in the evening he'd come home and turn on the Puccini and walk around the house. That was dad. And he'd be like, yeah, okay. The drama was right there in the living room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
During the first year of the pandemic, you wrote a play every day.
Yes.
And now, of course, your plays for the play gear is going to be produced at the Public. I heard from you that you had your first rehearsal today.
We did.
And and I should say that you are performing, acting, singing in this performance.
Yes, I am.
How? Can you please just, what was the...
I know. What's going on?
Huh?
Yes.
No. What was the impulse behind doing this everyday thing?
Right. Well, you know, no. I mean, we were all, you know, March 13th, what was it? March 13th, 2020?
2020,
it was.
Yeah.
Right? And we all were like minding our own business or at work or whatever. And they were like, we're shutting everything down. We're like, nah. And I said, I need to do something to prepare for the moment where we can, when we all get back together. And I said, I don't know what that is, but I'm going to write a play. I could just sit at home at our dining room table where I write. And while remote schooling, third grader in the one bedroom apartment, which was at the dining room table also, husband there too, we were living there, like all of us, closed off from each other. I just started writing a play a day. And I showed it to the folks at the Public Theater where I am one of the writers in residence. And Oscar Eustace said, this is great. Let's produce it. I said, okay. And then he said, well, you have to be in it. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah. Because I'd written one of the recurring characters in these little plays is called the writer. So I'd written myself into the plays without thinking that I was going to actually do it. I thought I was going to, you know, pass it on to a wonderful actor.
Yeah. Maybe this is like a very rote question, but what's it like to memorize on the level of performance your own lines?
It's a little strange. because I thought for a while, like, I told the actors, I'm not acting. Like, I said to them, you're acting. I'm just being myself. And then I realized, well, I'm actually not even doing that. I'm pretending to be myself. So I'm not quite sure what it all means, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love the fact that every time I read your bio somewhere, you always say her teacher was James Baldwin. you know, that sense of literary ancestry is so alive in you. I love that you always, that's always a part of the package that we get with you. How, I mean, as a 18-year-old, 19-year-old?
Yeah, nah, 19, 20... It's 80. Yeah, I'm old. So yeah, it was when I was 19, 20. Yeah, he taught at Hampshire College. I went to Mount Holyoke College, and you could take a class in the five college area, five college consortium. And I was one of the lucky ones, the 15 in the class, around a library table. He said it was the first creative writing class that he had taught, which is kind of amazing. And there we were sitting there, and I was very dorky and shy, and very animated when I was writing short stories then. Very animated when I would read them aloud like this, and then you know, and the characters, you know, I do all that, and he was just, you know, he was just like watching me like this. Yeah. And yeah, well, and he suggested that I write for the theater because I was so animated. I had no desire to write for the theater at all because theater people were all, you know, la di darling, darling, they would all talk like that. And here I am. So, yeah.
Do you notice any differences in how people start out in their sort of aspirations to be writers now that you're, you know, with students so often? One thing that I think about, you didn't go to grad school to write, for example. And now so many of the playwrights that we know, like institutions play a bigger part in creating artists these days, or nurturing or launching or whatever verb you want to use. Has that changed the structure of things or some of what we think of art? And
I think so. And again, the footnote to this is I teach at NYU, you know. So I have NYU, yeah, yeah, go Violets. And it's expensive. you know, right? Yeah, it's high. That bill is high. And I think that creates a lot of, in my students, I mean, not in y'all, but in my students, I think it creates a lot of unnecessary anxiety. When I graduate, I have to pay this bill. But also, the competitive nature of the institution creates a kind of anxiety that I think creates an artist, specifically a writer, who is, as they say on the wall of the new school as you pass by, desperate to make their mark on the world. I was never desperate to make my... I just wanted to do the best work I could. So I think there's an anxiety that's happening because of the way these institutions are training artists. And which is why I stayed at NYU, because I'm like, well, if the majority of the training is like this, then at least I can offer my, you know, outlook and my sort of say on, well, you know, throw my words into the pot, you know, with the others. Yeah.
In the Times the other day, you mentioned feeling a certain compulsion in our culture to perform a certain kind of, like, whether it's Black joy or some other feeling as a Black writer that you're expected to kind of broadcast. I was wondering if you could talk more about that. What does that compulsion feel like, and how have you dealt with it, circumvented it, ignored it, whatever?
We do expect certain things of certain people, and I feel like, as a Black woman, person, writer, human, certain things are expected of me, and certain things are like looked at. Why are you doing that? I have to, you know, I follow the spirit. So the thing about Black joy, which I think is important, I think I love to see Black people joyful on stage, on screen, everywhere. And we need to be clear about, in my opinion, where the joy really is. We're the marketplace is telling us that Black joy is what sells. I'm very suspicious about what the marketplace wants me to create, because I know, in my experience, where real Black joy resides. And sometimes that's in the place where there might be some traumatic thing that also happened. But two things, and why I feel this. So there are two things that make me really believe this, that we ought to take another look at this sort of rejection of trauma-based stories. That's very fashionable now. No more trauma-based stories. I heard professors at certain universities after Greeth, their acting students won't be in any demeaning roles, which includes any roles when they're slaves. I'm like, oh, gee, that's a lot of my plays. Okay, interesting. And if either, I'm just going to drop one more thing. WWJD, what would Jesus do? You know, and whether you believe in Jesus or not, it doesn't matter. That was a person who went into the stinky places. Now, if you want to follow someone great who did cool things, a lot of those, that kind of person did some cool shit because they weren't afraid to go into places where there was pain and suffering. So, again, I love a good black joyous story, and I think Top Dog is one.
Yeah.
But I'm not afraid of the painful places too.
Yeah.
You know.
On the one hand, Top Dog is about the love, as you say, but there, you know, there is tragedy involved. Like, what's the use of tragedy as a?
That's such a great question. I mean, I'm smiling because I'm writing about that right now in an essay that I'm writing. Yeah, because we don't think tragedy has a use anymore. You know, no, it's only good stuff. It's only happy stories, happy endings. If you write anything that approaches, you know, something that might make somebody uncomfortable. And I don't mean the titillating uncomfortable, like, ooh, I'm not talking about that. That's some bullshit, basically. I mean, let's be real, okay? I'm talking about the stuff that makes you reevaluate the way you are, the way you treat your neighbor. Oh, my goodness, I have to rethink some things on a deep level. Not, it made me a little squirmy. No, I'm not talking about that. So I do think that there is a great use of tragedy that we've forgotten about. And in the old, and again, I didn't go to grad school, so I'm just reading plays and coming up with some ideas out of the side of my neck. But in the old school, you know, like Greek tragedy, like Oedipus. Oedipus, you know, you guys know Oedipus, right? So that play, or if you don't know, just imagine, you know, it's an old play. Everybody in the theater going to see Oedipus would have known the ending already. Amazing, right? So it wasn't like, spoiler alerts weren't a thing back then. Everybody knew, oh, Oedipus, hey, he's really related to that lady that he married. That's really his mother. So they're sitting back going, yeah, this is going to be really interesting. They come to the theater knowing the story. And yet, the story is so all-enveloping that it's so moving and it creates things like catharsis. It kind of shocks them. It wakes them up. It moves them to reconsider basic aspects of their life. That's cool shit. You know what I mean? Now, just eating like sugar, entertainment, while it's really nice, ain't going to do that. Entertainment is going to anesthetize you and make you buy shit that you don't need. So I'm encouraging us to, as human beings, we have the equipment to do incredible things. So what are we waiting for? You know, right? What are we waiting for?
Susan Lori Parks. Her Pulitzer Prize winning play, Top Dog Underdog, has just been revived on Broadway. And she spoke with Vincent Cunningham as part of the New Yorker Festival this month.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.